All right, well, I have 6:31 by my clock, so I think we'll go ahead and start. So, yes, we are beginning to study the book of Revelation, which, before I say anything, what are you guys' impressions, assumptions, beliefs? What do you guys say the book of Revelation is all about? Yeah, I mean that's a lot of people's opinion is they've heard so many contradictory things about it. They've heard so many different things, and the imagery in the book is I mean, really strong, sometimes kind of strange imagery. So thinking it just sometimes becomes overwhelming for people, which is what happens in the source material which John is using, which is Zechariah, Isaiah, particularly Ezekiel and Zechariah can get really weird. In their descriptions of things. And so, yeah, a lot of people look at Revelation and they're just overall intimidated by it because it's not an easy book by our standards. We like the Apostle Paul because we're Western. Our entire society's been built, well, until your generation and my generation is kind of the last one to be there, people that are older millennials, where you're built on a very rational worldview, a very logical worldview. One thing leads to another, and that is not what John is. I mean, John is very specific. John writes in the Revelation, he writes very clearly, very, very logically, but it's a different kind of logic. It's not what we normally consider Western rational logic. So absolutely great point. Great point, Connie. Yeah. So what do you know about, since you brought up pre-trib and post-trib, what do you know about pre-trib and post-trib? Yeah, and then within the mid-trib, there are a couple different positions. There's like partial mid-trib, and then there's like complete mid-trib. And incidentally, interestingly, the people who all believe in partial mid-trib, we'll get into this, so this is just a fun joke, but the people who believe in partial mid-trib rapture, which are people who believe that all the super-duper saints get taken out, you know, early, and then that's the partial part, and then later, after people have suffered a little bit, then they get raptured out. All the people who advocate that view all believe they're going to be taken out in the first rapture. Yeah, exactly. The 144,000. So yeah. Yeah, definitely there are. There are, as one professor I had said, if you can imagine it, there is somebody who believes it when it comes to belief about interpretation of the book of Revelation. Eschatology is the broad name, the big fancy theological name. It comes from the Greek word eschatos, and it means the last things. So eschatology is the study of last things. And so when people talk about the study of prophecy, they talk about studying the book of Revelation, the prophetic books, again, particularly the major prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, although Daniel's technically a minor prophet, by some people's estimation, or he's a writing by some people's estimation, and then you have Zechariah and Joel. A lot of those Matthew, portions of Matthew, and then Revelation are the major portions of Scripture that speak to eschatology in an extended sense. Other things we know or believe or tend to think about the book of Revelation. It's a historical account of future events. That is my take on it. That is what I will be teaching and how I will be presenting the material, but that is not everybody's take. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But yes, that is, I believe, is the most sensible way to approach the text. We'll go through reasons, especially as we're studying the book, of why I think that's the best approach to take. But yeah, that is my take. The question then becomes, hey, Marcia. Hey, Dan. The question then becomes, what do we mean by historical? What do we mean, by those terms? And so that's, I know what you mean, and I agree with you because I know what you mean. But those are terms that can get really complicated and confusing if we're not sure what we mean. So that's why it's important to kind of parse these things out. Other things that we think or we know we think or we're confused about when it comes to the book of Revelation, just overall stuff. Who's the main character of the Revelation? John the author? Okay. That's a good interpretation. Any other thoughts? Who's the main character? Jesus. A lot of people think Antichrist. You know, when they think about the Revelation, they think that it's a book about the tribulation. And material-wise, the tribulation period covers everything really from chapter 4 to chapter the end of 18. So 4:1 through 18:20 something. That's all the tribulation period. But chapters 1, 2, and 3 are not the tribulation. And then, of course, chapters 19 through 22 are talking about the millennial reign of Jesus Christ and then on into eternity. And so it's easy to look at the book of Revelation and say, well, look, the preponderance of material, the vast majority of material is about the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls and the three woes, and looking at that material and say, well, that's what takes up all the material, so that's what the book's about. But that would be a wrong conclusion. The book, as Deanne said, the book, the main character, well, like Brian said, is John. John is the author. He is the one who is telling us, and John appears personally more than anybody else in the book, except maybe God, because almost throughout the entire book, he's saying, I saw, I heard. He's constantly interacting with the elders. He's interacting with at least one angel. He interacts with Jesus and maybe God the Father himself. And so John features prominently in the book. And when we, in a couple weeks, we'll talk about, you know, what John actually saw. We'll talk about an overview of the book of Revelation. But yeah, both of those answers are true in their own way. Like, John is the main character in the sense that he's the one who's seeing everything. But all of the events are focused on Jesus Christ. The real turning point in the book of Revelation, and I'll say this again in a couple weeks, the turning point of the Revelation is in chapter 11, where they say the kingdom of this world is become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ. And that's, of course, you know, that wonderful line from Handel's Messiah, where, you know, the choir sings that the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ. That's what the whole book is about. The book of Revelation, we'll talk about this later, but the book of Revelation is about two empires, the empire of the world, the kingdom of the world, and the kingdom of God, and how the kingdom of God takes over. The kingdom of the world becomes the kingdom of God and of his Christ. It's a book of opposites. John is, we'll talk about this again when we get into John. I'll just stop right here so we don't get too far, but yeah. Okay, so yeah, so we have a lot of assumptions about the book of Revelation, and most of the assumptions come from a lot of the bad interpretations. Let me start there. Almost all of the bad interpretations of Revelation come from a couple of sources, and all of those sources come from one of two things. All the sources of bad interpretation come from one of two things. One, having an inadequate knowledge of the rest of the Bible. If you don't have a working knowledge of the rest of the Bible, you can't understand Revelation. Revelation is the 66th book. It was possibly the last book written. Most people would say it was definitely the last book written. Other people say the Gospel of John actually may have been written last. But it is the 66th book of the Bible. And to know it, you have to know the other 65 books. So this is the 66th book of the Bible. You got to know the other 65. So if you don't have a good working knowledge of the rest of the Bible, it's going to be really hard to make sense of the Revelation. The second source of really bad interpretation is having a bad interpretive method. So if your interpretive method of studying this, of studying Revelation is bad, you're not going to understand the Revelation. So let's talk about interpretive methods. So there are four, and you can find this in your books. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to, but that book is really, really helpful. I really enjoyed it. There are four big ways that people try to interpret the book of Revelation, and there are, of course, little twists and turns and attempts to modify these positions, but largely there are four positions. I'll come to the one that I hold last. So the first position is called the historicist position, the historicist position. Now, the historicist position is kind of a weird one when you think about it logically. But when you look around and read the news and you read what people preach and you read what people say, you'll find that it's, at the popular level, the most popular interpretation of Revelation. So the historicist position is basically that the book of Revelation is being lived out contemporarily in history. And so this is where you get a lot of date setting. People who say, oh, you know, the COVID vaccine, that's the mark of the beast. No, it's not, because it doesn't refer directly to the Antichrist and it doesn't force anybody to actually worship the Antichrist and Satan. Now, here's the thing. Here's the problem with Here's the good thing about the historicist position. So the historicist position, just to review, the historicist position is largely a view that says John is seeing all of history. He's seeing all of human history going forward, and events, a lot of times they'll say that chapters 2 and 3 about the church are talking about great ages of the church. So there was an Ephesian age of the church, and people wouldn't typically say that was the apostolic and post-apostolic age, so the first like 100 or 200 years of the church. And they'll say, like, well, what happened to the church in Ephesus? Well, the church in Ephesus was really good, but they lost their first love. Well, and what happened to the early church in the first 200 years? They were a really good church, but they lost their first love. And what happened to the church in Ephesus? Jesus warns that he will come and snuff out their candle. What happened to the church in Asia Minor? Well, today it's modern-day Turkey. There is no real church in there. The Hagia Sophia has the crescent sitting on top of it, okay? So so that's there, and they're going to say that all of the churches are historically some period in church history. And it really makes a lot of sense if you can be a little bit loosey-goosey with how you interpret things, right? So if you can interpret symbols to mean whatever you want them to mean, you can make a really good argument for the historicist position. The problem is can you make symbols mean whatever they mean? The symbolic language in the Bible, so Brian mentioned earlier that it's a history written from the past, so it's a future history, okay? So the question is, if that's true, is John using symbolic language? Is he using literal language? Is everything literally fulfilled? So when it talks about the locusts who had the breastplates of iron and they had the scorpion tails, is that literally what happened? Like someday during the tribulation, there are going to be locusts that have breastplates of iron and they have scorpion tails? Or is that symbolic language? And if it's symbolic language, is that John looking and seeing helicopter drones up there shooting rockets at people? Or is that what John actually saw? And John recorded what he actually saw, but it was symbolic. It was a symbolic vision given to John that he wrote down literally. Or was John seeing events as they will actually happen and then using symbolic language to describe it? No matter which way you go, you have to choose. You have to choose whether they're symbols or not. And then if they're symbols, is there a concrete way to interpret the symbols? The historicist does not have a concrete fixed way of interpreting symbols. People like me, people who are futurists, and actually some people who aren't even futurists, they will look at the symbols of the Bible and they'll say, there are interpretive methods we can use to make sense of what the symbols are. Sometimes John tells us what the symbols are. And if John tells us what the symbol is, there's no reason for you to mistake what the symbol is. If he says, this means this, well, then that means that. There are other interpretive methods. It's something called the law of first mention. So the law of first mention is when you see a symbol in a prophetic book, or John is called an apocalypse, it's a revelation. When you see a symbol, go back to the first time that was mentioned in the Bible and say, well, what did this symbol mean the first time we saw it? Because it's very likely that it will have a similar meaning. Or if a symbol is used in multiple different ways throughout the Bible, like water is used symbolically in a lot of different ways in the Bible. So the question is, does this have just one of those meanings? Like when we talk about the water, the spring of the water of life in the new heavens and new earth? Okay, does water, is there actually going to be a river, or is that symbolic? And if it's symbolic, what is it symbolic of? The historicist can make it be whatever they want to be. The futurist says, no, we have to have some rules about this. We have to be able to have some rigor so that we can determine what this actually means. Is everybody with me so far? I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but it's important to understand that there is something to be said for the historicist position in that they can make really good arguments, right? They can make really good arguments. The problem is all their arguments rest upon them being able to interpret any symbol any way they want. Now, here's where they're right, and here's where I think the historicists have been absolutely right. When you look at their argument, so the historicists are constantly, I remember in my lifetime, there have been so many antichrists. It's amazing. There have been so many antichrists. You know, Saddam Hussein was the antichrist. George Bush was the antichrist. Barack Obama was the antichrist. You know, like Donald Trump, I'm pretty sure I've heard, Joe Biden, they're all the antichrist, right? Like Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un, both of them were the antichrist. There are all these people who are the antichrist. And before my lifetime, how many antichrists were there? Well, there were so many. Adolf Hitler. Before Hitler, it was Napoleon. Before Napoleon, it was Genghis Khan, right? So the church, there have always been people saying, well, that's the antichrist. Now, here's where they actually have a point. People say, ah, Social Security. I remember years ago, I was very convinced by this until some very kind people disabused me of it. Social Security cards, that's a mark of the beast. Well, not sure. Not so sure about that. Oh, cashless society, that's the mark of the beast. You won't be able to buy or sell. Well, here's where they're right. Satan, who does not know the end? Who does not know when the end is? Satan doesn't. So if Satan wants to be prepared, what does he have to have? He has got to have an Antichrist in the wings all the time. He has got to have a mark of the beast in the wings at all times. So where the historicist is right is, could Napoleon have been the Antichrist? Maybe. Could Hitler have been? Maybe. But it wasn't time yet. Satan always has to have somebody ready to go because he doesn't know when the end is. But he does want to put an Antichrist on the throne so that he can deceive the nations. He does want to do that. So he's got to have somebody ready. And when we talk about people say, oh, that's the mark of the beast. Okay, no. The COVID vaccine isn't the mark of the beast. If you're walking around with a phone that constantly tracks your data and you're worried about the vaccine, like, okay, there are more important things to worry about, people, the government tracking you, than the COVID vaccine. But here's the deal. Can COVID vaccine transport cards, what are they calling them? Like your walk-in papers, what are they calling those? Your vaccination passport, that's the term they're using, right? Is a vaccination passport maybe an indication of how there could be something like a mark of the beast in the future? Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. We can definitely see how something like that could be very doable. But until we can have a concrete interpretation of those things, we can't say. It's just guessing. And so far, everybody who has guessed has been wrong. So maybe we should quit guessing. Okay, anyway, so that's the historicist position. The preterist position. Now, this is a position. I'll go over the preterist position. These names are actually kind of confusing because you call it the historicist position, and you would actually think that the historicist position would be the preterist position because of that it's in history, and it's, you would think the preterist would be, it's weird. So the terms are kind of confusing, but you're not going to have to worry about these, but I want you to know what they are. So the preterist position is basically this. There are two kinds of preterists. There are full preterists, who are heretics, and there are moderate preterists. Preterists believe that all of the revelation was already fulfilled in John's lifetime. They believe that the events in the Revelation are referring to the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem, the fall of the city of Jerusalem that happened in 70 AD. The problem is that most people, and there's really good evidence that Revelation wasn't written until 90 AD. So that's kind of a problem. Like, John gives us like the place where he writes it. He says, I was on the Isle of Patmos. So preterists really run into a lot of problems. They want to interpret everything in a historical backdrop. They want to say, okay, well, the Antichrist is Nero Caesar, or the Antichrist is Titus, or they want to find these ways of interpreting it, and they talk about, you know, now the kingdom of God is here. So that's kind of that position. I don't want to spend much time talking about it because I think it's kind of a ridiculous position and it doesn't get a lot of tread. However, it does get a lot of traction in some of your more liberal seminaries. That tends to be, at least for a while, that was kind of the interpretive method that people were really hot for, or people will do a mixed version where they'll say, well, some of these things were already fulfilled in John's lifetime, and he's describing them, and he's talking about them as future events, even though they're past events, and he's writing a poetic writing about what has already happened. You get some weird views of people trying to defend that, but that's the preterist view, and again, don't need to worry too much about the preterist view. So you got the historicists, you got the preterists. What do the preterists get right? What do they do that I think is good? Is I think they try, I think they're trying to nail down what the symbols mean. And that's actually not a bad thing. That's something they do well. They say, well, these things have to mean something. They can't just mean everything. We'll get to why they can't mean everything in a second. But they got to mean something, and they got to mean something concrete. John saw something, and we want to know what that something is. Now, the problem is that they take symbols really, really seriously, and they take common uses of language really, really unseriously. Because John says, after these things, and uses future tense verbs, and talks about what he's going to see in the future and what will happen, and they don't take those things seriously. So they'll take the symbol seriously, and they'll say, the symbol has to have a concrete meaning. And then John says, I don't know how many times in his book, like 20 sometimes he says, metatauta, after these things, okay, but they don't take that part seriously. Jesus says in chapter one of the Revelation, he says, write what you have seen, what is, and what will be, but they don't take that seriously. So that's kind of the sword that the preterist position falls on, okay? We have what's called the spiritualist position or the spiritual position. That's kind of the third. And this is kind of the most popular position throughout church history. And that is largely, if you talk to a Catholic, a Lutheran, a lot of Presbyterians, Methodists, if you talk to a lot of people, this is where they're going to land. And what they do is, it's very similar to the historicist position in that they'll say, well, this is probably future. They'll say that this is probably future, and it's going to happen someday. It hasn't happened yet. But all of this can be interpreted spiritually. Or they'll say it's not future at all, that this is actually just a description of the constant cosmic struggle that's going on between the church and Satan. And it talks about the ultimate victory that the church has, or sometimes the ultimate victory that the church has already had over Satan. A lot of people who would be spiritualists, they would say that we're actually living in the millennium right now. If this is the millennium, I kind of want to talk to Jesus about that and find out, you know, how I'm misreading the text to think that this is heaven on earth. But a lot of people will take that position in the spiritualist position. What the spiritualist position gets right is they, I'm trying to think of what they actually do well. that was as smug as I meant it to be. What they do well, I think, is they are trying really, really hard to see. They're trying really hard not to go off the rails. And they have a lot of historical support. This is the traditional position of the church for a really long time. I mean, really from 300, AD 300 on, I mean, pretty much everybody was a spiritualist in some kind. Why did that happen, though? Does anybody want to take a guess why the church went from before the 300s, most people were called Kileists. They were people who believed in a literal thousand-year reign. They were futurists. They were premillennialists. We'll talk about premillennialism in a second. Why is it that for the first 300 years of the church, people said Revelation is pointing to the future when there was going to be a literal physical return of Jesus Christ and he's going to have a literal physical thousand-year reign in Jerusalem? To somewhere around 300 AD, all of a sudden the church is like, maybe not. Why is that, you guys think? Can you guys think of any major events, that any major cultural changes that happened in the 300s? What were the great eras of persecution in the church when the church was persecuted by the Roman Empire? Before the 300s. So under Nero Caesar, so you had some really big persecution in the first century, really big persecution in the third century, in the 200s, another really big one. Then in the 300s, Christianity has grown, and it's a really big group. The persecutions of the church that happened in the third century were not able to smash it, were not able to squash it. Paganism was losing. And now the Christians, now there's a huge number of people in the Roman Empire who are Christians, and so their status is changing. There are Christians in government, and eventually Constantine is going to what? He's going to become a Christian. He's going to see, you guys know that IHS that we always see, you know, some people have IHS on the cross, or they'll have it on their car if they're Catholic. In IHS is in hic signo. It's Latin for in this sign. That was what Constantine said he saw in a dream before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. He was fighting against some people, and this was going to allow him to be the emperor if he won the battle, and he saw a cross, and he heard the voice, in this sign, go and conquer. And so Constantine puts a cross, according to the story, Constantine has his soldiers put crosses on their shields instead of the Roman eagle, the legionnaire eagle, and they go out and they win. Constantine becomes the emperor. And then what happens? His son forces everyone in the empire to become Christian. So here's the problem. Under Augustine, not Constantine, but under Augustine, Augustine is writing, and he's saying, well, what do we do? There are two empires. There are two cities. One of Augustine's great works, most people would say it's Augustine's greatest work, is called Civitas Dei, the City of God. And Augustine writes about the City of God, and he says that Rome is great. Rome was great in a lot of ways, but Rome has failed. Rome is falling to the barbarians. And Augustine sees how there has to be another city, a city of God, because the city of Rome will fail. But Christians, in this era, they started to change their understanding of the future because, wait a minute, how can the empires of the world be evil? How can there be coming a future Antichrist coming out of the Roman Empire, which was always the traditional interpretation, if the Roman emperor himself is a Christian? It doesn't make sense. Now, what didn't those Christians in, 380 AD, what didn't they know? Well, they didn't know that the Roman Empire was going to fall on some hard times. They didn't know that all of Europe was going to apostatize. They didn't know that things were going to change dramatically. They didn't know those things. They were looking from their context. So what happens? Well, what happens also in the 300s through the 500s? A lot of the great theologians come along, and how do they interpret prophecy? They interpret it spiritually. And so what happens then when Catholicism follows on the tradition of the elders in their interpretation? Well, Catholicism keeps that going for another couple hundred years. What happens then when Luther comes along? Luther's like, yeah, that's what we've always taught, so we'll keep teaching it. It's one of those things where it perpetuates itself, but it came out of an interpretation of history that really held until, what, 1800? I mean, most princes would consider themselves Christians. Most people considered Europe a Christian continent, all of Christendom. So for them, it made a lot of sense. Looking at it from our perspective, we're like, maybe it doesn't make so much sense. Anyways, that's the spiritualist position. Now the last position, and the one that I hold, is called the futurist position. The futurist position is this. And this is really tricky, so make sure you follow the language. The futurist position says that the majority of the book of Revelation is going to happen in the future. So, if you've got a pen to take, one more time, if you got a pen, write this down, take your notes. Yeah, the futurist position is the events of Revelation are happening in the future. They're happening in the future. And so my take is that chapter one was the things which are, the things that were, I'm sorry, the things that have already happened when John is addressed. Chapters two and three are the things that are, that is the church in the present age. There are a lot of good reasons why. We will talk about those when we get there. And then chapters 4 through 22 are the things that will be. That's what Jesus tells John to write. Write the things that were, the things that are, the things that shall be, the things that will be. And so the futurist position says, well, John said it was future, so we're going to take it as future. And then we run into the problem. So we're going to teach from the futurist position. What's the benefit of the futurist position? What's the benefit of it? That it's the correct one. That's really the benefit of studying. Okay, I'll have to laugh so you guys know I'm half joking, right? So the benefit of the futurist position is that it is the most literal interpretation of the book of Revelation. If you want to be literal, be a futurist. John MacArthur had a wonderful sermon series on this. He was talking about why everybody who's a Calvinist should also be a premillennial futurist. You don't have to be a Calvinist. I'm not a Calvinist, but that was his take. He's like, if you believe in taking the scriptures literally, if you believe in following the fundamental rules and laws of hermeneutics means the rules of interpreting the scripture, then you should be a futurist. You should believe in that. So now, we've talked about the four great views, the four big ways of interpreting the scriptures. Now we have, I think Deanne alluded to it, you've got three more big dividers, and that is premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism. Again, really tricky terms. Premillennialism means that Jesus will return pre the millennium. If you know what the term refers to, it makes a lot of sense. These are actually pretty easy. Futurist is easy. Historicist, kind of easy. Spiritualist, definitely easy. Premillennialist, very easy term to understand if you know what it refers to. It refers to when is the return of Jesus going to happen. Does the return of Jesus come before the millennium? Postmillennialists believe it comes post, after the millennium. And amillennialists believe that it will not happen at all, that there will not be a millennium. Not that Jesus won't return, but that there isn't going to be a millennium. They think that people like me are overemphasizing the like 11 times that the word 1,000 years is used in Revelation chapter 20. So those are the three big views. Now, Almost everybody who is a futurist, in fact, I don't know of anybody who isn't a futurist who is a post-millennialist. I don't know that there are. Typically, premillennialism and futurism go together. Now, you've got the preterist view. Preterists tend to be amillennialists, or they believe that we're in the millennium, so they're kind of like current millennialists. They're kind of weird. But then you've got the spiritualists and the historicists. Again, the historicists are weird. It's really hard to nail down what they believe because they do a lot of newspaper exegesis. But the spiritualists, because that's the majority of the church, at least throughout church history, they're gonna split somewhere between postmillennialism and amillennialism. They're gonna say one of two things. One, either the church is going to win ultimate victory in the world, and that Jesus is going to return after the world is converted. That's one of the standard postmillennial views. Or they're gonna be amillennialists and say, there is not going to be a millennium. Jesus is going to return, and there's going to be a dramatic judgment, and then we enter into the eternal state. Either we go with God to heaven, we don't stay on earth, is a lot of those people's view, or they'll say there will be a completely new planet. The new earth means the earth will literally be like destroyed, blown up, and made new, and we're going to have something like that. So those are the three kind of views. So they kind of have tracks where they go together. And then if you're a person who believes in a rapture, you have three major views. We talked about these already. You have your pre-trib, your mid-trib, your post-trib, and then, of course, you got partial trib, but we're not going to worry about that. So your pre-tribulation rapture people are people like me who look at chapter 4:1 and say, metatauta, after these things, what things the church thinks, chapters 2 and 3, after the church. Notice that the word ecclesia is used over and over and over in chapters 2 and 3. It is not used, I think, in the rest of the book. Maybe it's used in the very last chapter, but it is not used during the entire tribulation period. And then he says, come up here. And then, of course, we have other passages of Scripture we would look at. We would look at 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. We would look at a lot of other places in Scripture where there seems to be an argument or support for some kind of rapture. So pre-tribbers like me are looking at the text and saying, well, we don't see a church in the tribulation, and we believe that there's a rapture, and so that's how we're going to interpret things. Mid-tribbers say, well, we think that, and the reason is they interpret the way they interpret the 3.5 years. So remember, there were the 70 years of Daniel, right? And we've had 69 of the 70 weeks of Daniel. That is mathematically demonstrable that Jesus literally was crucified to the day from the dedication of the temple. So, I mean, it is amazing math. If you've never studied the 70 weeks of Daniel, it is worth your time. Go home and do it. But there are still seven years unaccounted for. There's 1 week of Daniel unaccounted for. A lot of people believe that that's at least part of the tribulation, if not the entire tribulation itself. Daniel is a hugely important book for this study. We're going to spend some time in Daniel. But Daniel talks about what? He talks about 3.5 years of peace. Antichrist is going to make peace with people for 3.5 years. 3.5 years into the tribulation, he's going to break that peace, and there's going to be widespread persecution of the Jewish people for 3.5 years. So that's the 70th week of Daniel. Mid-tribbers say they're seeing themselves as the church, or at least as part of the people of God, and they say, oh, well, we see the church is there for half of it, and then they leave. And then you've got post-trib people. I'm not really sure. Honestly, I can't remember off the top of my head what their arguments are. I think a lot of post-trib people say that the church needs to suffer, that the church throughout history has always been suffering, and that it's really unfair if the church doesn't suffer then, which makes you wonder, why are they raptured at all? Like, if Jesus raptures them and immediately they come back down to the earth for Jesus to rule and reign, it's like, I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense. I think that there are better arguments. They make their arguments, and if you're interested, you can read them. They're widely available. But those are the big views of those are the big things to keep in mind. So again, where am I coming from? I am coming from a futurist position. I believe that chapters 4 through 22 of Revelation were all future. They were future, and they will continue to be future. The reason why I don't do newspaper exegesis, the reason why you will never see me, unless I have like a high fever or a closed head injury, you will never see me in the pulpit saying, that's the mark of the beast. is because I don't believe that we will see those things until the rapture has already happened. And at that point, you're going to have better preachers than me anyway. So you guys will be hanging out with cool people in heaven. But that's why I don't. That's why I don't bother with that stuff. So I'm a futurist. I believe that chapters 4 through 22 happen after the rapture of the church. I'm a premillennialist, which of course means I believe Jesus will return. So that's Jesus, Revelation 19, when Jesus returns, that happens before the millennium. Why am I a premillennialist? Because I believe, again, this is why you go to seminary. I believe that 19 comes before 20. So I know. I'm telling you. I think I paid $1,500 for that one. So you get to, yeah, exactly. Two big revelations. So I believe that we can take John as reliable in its order of events, okay? There is one place where I believe that John is doing a parenthesis, and he has, it's a short one, but I think we'll explain that, but that's Revelation 12. We'll talk about Revelation 12 at length. We'll probably spend a couple weeks there, but Revelation 12 has been called by some, there was a famous scholar, and he said, you tell me your interpretation of the woman in Revelation 12, and I'll tell you your interpretation of prophecy. And it's largely true. I mean, you can really, if you let somebody talk long enough on what they think about the woman in Revelation 12, you'll know what they think about future things. Because that is a watershed issue. Anyways, I think John is reliable. I think the fact that he uses all these, they're called temporal markers. It means then, after, these things that are time words. I think John uses those, and I think they actually have a meaning. And I think they mean that things are going to happen sequentially. So I believe that Revelation 20 comes after Revelation 19. Revelation 19 is the return of Jesus to the world. And chapter 20 has the millennial reign of Christ. So I believe that 20 happens after 19. So that's why I believe that. Jesus returns pre the millennium. And of course, I'm a pre-tribber, and I've already explained why I'm a pre-tribber. So you guys do not have to agree with me. I think everybody already knows that. You guys are free to disagree with me. If you disagree with me, you'll be in really, really good company. Some of my best friends disagree with me strongly on this stuff. So you'll be in really good company. You'll be wrong, but you'll be in really good company. So you can take solace in that. But yeah, so I am teaching from a very specific perspective of the book of Revelation, and I think that it makes the most sense. Of course, I gave you guys, we bought those books, the book The End. You will not need to read through that very quickly, but if you do, if you get into it and you're, yeah, tell them, Mark, and you read it and you really enjoy it, that is as close to exactly what I believe as you're likely to find. I mean, there are like two extremely minor issues that I disagree with him on. And other than that, I mean, I'm shot for shot agreeing with him. I think he did a really good job of presenting the material. A lot of what I said here rather quickly, you can find, he lays it out. He's got really nice charts on, you know, understanding the views of prophecy, the views of history. It's a really well-made book. So you've got that. Follow along with Dr. Hitchcock. Again, you don't have to agree with me or Dr. Hitchcock, but I'm hoping that no matter what, you'll gain a better appreciation for the book of Revelation. If you disagree with me, say so. We'll talk about it. We'll debate it. We'll argue about it in a loving way. But that's fun. I am not intimidated by people disagreeing with me. You know, I live with four small children. You guys have all had small children, so you know how dumb you are, because little children love to tell you. So they... anyways, I won't get bogged down in that. But you guys know what it's all about, kids. Please disagree with me if you disagree. Challenge me if you think I need to be challenged. If I'm wrong, just say so. I can't improve unless I'm told that I'm wrong. So you've got the book by Dr. Hitchcock. I also gave. You guys have these binders. In these binders, I tried to make the print wide enough. I double spaced this so you guys can make notes. I maybe should have triple spaced it, but I tried to make this fairly large font. I put them in binders so that when we need to, we can flip from passage to passage. You know, if I'm saying, hey, we need to reference this passage, we need to look at this part of the Revelation, you can move through. I did put the words of Jesus in red, so really, there aren't that many words of Jesus. I mean, there are chapters 2 and 3, parts of the end, and then I think one in chapter 16 where there's Jesus speaking. But here's the deal with this translation. This is my translation, and as I translated this, this is how I normally translate anything for the church. So you guys have probably remembered this from sermons. This is not a good translation. This is a bad translation. This is a deliberately bad translation. What do I mean by a bad translation? Every time you translate a word, every word has what's called an unaffected meaning and a contextual meaning, right? We all know this, right? We understand this. So like if I say the word strawberry, probably all of you thought of a red fruit with a frilly green top, right? That's the unaffected meaning of the word. But not every time do we say strawberry do you need to think of that? Like if we talk about strawberry jam, we're thinking about something slightly different, or we're thinking about the flavor. Or if I say raspberry, here's a better example, right? If I say raspberry, you're thinking of a fruit. The unaffected meaning is a small berry-like fruit. Well, were you thinking of a red or a black? Or maybe you were thinking of somebody getting scraped up sliding in baseball, right? So all languages have this. All languages have words that have a range of meanings. And so what I have done is I have picked the most basic standard meaning of these words, and I have tried my very best not to use the same English word for multiple Greek words, right? So there's a really important distinction that John makes in the Revelation. I'm finishing up here, so if you're getting antsy, I'm almost done here. But there are two words for living somewhere in Revelation. There's the word katoikeo, which means to be in a house, and that means dwell. There's also the word skeneo. Skeneo comes from the word skenos, which means a tent. You guys may have heard of like a skein of something, S-K-E-I-N. I think it's a sewing term. People talk about skeins in sewing. Anyways, it means to pitch your tent. Now, a lot of times English translations will translate both of those as dwell. I have differentiated them. Why? Because God differentiates them. John, when he wrote, he is using kaoikeo. He's using the word dwell only for the people of the world, those who dwell in the world. You will see that expression over and over and over, those who are dwelling in the world. Where do you see the word skeneo, the people who are tenting? That's only used for God and the people of God, right? So that's why I'm translating that. I am translating that so you will see. It's a bad translation. I'm telling you right away, it is a bad translation. A lot of this is really ugly English. It doesn't make a lot of sense sometimes. But I'm trying to help you have as few barriers between you and the Greek text as possible so that when you read this, you're going to see things, hopefully, you're going to see things that you're like, oh my gosh, I never made that connection before. I had so many of those moments. At the bottom, you'll see there are text notes. Some of them are really long. Some of them are very short. They're just like, hey, see this passage because there's a passage there where there's the same rare word used, or there's an expression that's very similar. So this is what I'm going to be teaching out of. I'm not going to be teaching out of the NIV or anything like that. Please, for your own reading, like, don't make this your devotional reading. I mean, if you want to read this, I would highly recommend reading through my translation a couple times so you know where I'm going, and maybe you can see some of those things. But again, this is not a translation that Zondervan's ever going to publish, okay? Like, they're not going to because it's really bad. This took me about 50 hours. It would take, I mean, the really good translations that come out, they take tens of thousands of hours. I mean, people put enormous amounts of work into these books of the Bible, and they're really excellent scholars, and I am not. But this is what we're going to be teaching out of. So I've given you binders also for one, because I think it'll be easier than if this were stapled or bound in some way, but also in case we have printouts, because there'll probably be printouts and other handouts that I'll pass out to you guys. And so all of that stuff will be made available on the website, but it'll also be available as a handout for you guys. I know that this was not the most exciting first Bible study. It was a lot of overview material. Next week, we're going to do an overview of John and possibly an overview of the Revelation, and then after that, so either in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks, we're going to dive right into chapter 1:1, and we're gonna move. And you know, if you guys are really interested and you guys are talking a lot, we'll get through a short passage. And if you guys just say, you know, when is this going to be over? Then we'll probably get through a lot of material, depending on how chatty I get. So, does anybody have any questions before we finish up? No. If I use a Latin expression that you don't know, just say, hey, I don't know what that means. Just say, dude, just chill. Chill with Latin, okay? Just tell me that. So, yeah. So, yep. You will not need to know Latin words. If I say them and I don't explain them, please just say, like, you're being a jerk, okay? So nobody, you're not impressing anybody, nobody cares. So, yeah, that I hope that answers the question. Any other questions? The reason I didn't print out a syllabus for where we're going is because I don't know how long it's going to take. There are going to be passages where we might get through half of a verse in a week, and there might be some where we get through an entire chapter. I mean, it really just depends on how interested we are or whether things just happen to click with us or connect with us. But this has been, I will close with this, and then I promise I will shut up. Preparing this Bible study for you guys has been, I want to thank you guys as the church for hiring me and allowing me to do things like this. A lot of you guys are leaders here in the church. All of you actually are leaders in the church. And so the fact that as a pastor, I'm allowed to do things like this is such a blessing to me, because I have had such a tremendous joy reading and studying and translating Revelation, and hopefully I can pass that to you guys. Hopefully you guys can get some, not because you guys are incapable, but just because it is so much more of a blessing for me to research. Same thing with preaching through the Gospel of Mark. It has been such a blessing for me to be reading through it in the original languages and studying and thinking on the Gospel of Mark over the course of a year. So thank you guys. Thank you as the church. And I hope this is a real blessing to us. We'll talk about why we should study Revelation next week, but this has been a great blessing, so thank you guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's see that
one. Well, and if, yeah, and... I like that. Oh, see, she's already using the terminology. She's... I'm gonna get some Gold Star stickers, and Deanne is going to have all of them. That's what's gonna happen. Great.